たからせのよいよい
And good morning. You are tuned into KBOO Community Radio. And today, I know you've been tuning in to KBOO, so you know what today is because you're like, oh my God, that promo has been playing forever. It is APA Heritage Day here on KBOO because the month of May is APA Heritage Month, according to our government, because, you know, we all need special months. We'll get into that. I have all sorts of opinions. But I'm joined with someone who also has lots of opinions. I am joined today. Well, this is why I brought you in. She's looking at me like, what opinions? Me? No. Chisel. That's right. I brought in Chisel Hatha. She is a teacher, dancer, artist, writer, activist. The list goes on and on. I think of her as one of my mentors, and she's come on to this hour that is usually positively revolting. So thank you for tuning in. You know, usually this is feminist talk. So Chisel, I couldn't think of anyone better to bring in. Chisel does so much here in the city. Welcome, Chisel Hatha.
Thank you, Jenna Yokoyama.
Okay, so from the beginning, we just had to bring on that song. I chose that song in the introduction because you and I recently have been talking about the Japanese Obon Festival that happens every year here in Portland, and there's dancing that happens at it, and that is probably one of the more popular, famous dances, songs that happens. It's called Tankubushi. It's a coal miner song. The whole dance is about coal mining. I don't know, and I just, when I thought of Chisel, I was just like, dancer, Obon, Asian time.
It's a very significant
Tankubushi
song, Tankubushi. Not that we're for coal mining anymore, for sure. But I'm having this image of when I was in Kyoto, and it was during Obon time, and there is like lots of floats, really big floats, you know, going through the streets of Kyoto. And then you have a stick, and you write a prayer on the stick. It's kind of a big, you know, stick. And all the sticks are gathered up, and then they're like hauled up the mountainside. And you sit across from the mountain, and you can see these big kanjis, or these symbols, that burn. So your sticks, along with thousands of other sticks, are burning to light the sky, and they're shaped in a boat and two other things that I can't quite remember because I don't read kanji. But the idea is that your prayers are lighting the sky for this one time for your ancestors to look down and even come and assist you. If you need it, you can ask for assistance.
Maybe I'll do that this summer at the Obon in Portland.
It's here. So beautiful because it is the tradition of Obon. It's like Christmas for many Japanese families.
Yeah.
It's when everybody returns home and they celebrate home, they celebrate with special food, and then these dances are part of what is the lineage that's come from Japan to America. And now in every city where there is a Japanese American community, and they do have people who organize an Obon celebration or a dance, a community dance and prayers, then it always ends with this song, with the Tankubushi. So if you know, I mean, every Obon is different in the United States, from New York to Denver to San Jose to San Francisco to Los Angeles to Portland to Seattle, but every single one, it, you can go to
and dance Tankubushi.
And dance Tankubushi.
And they might do it a little bit different
at
each temple. And I think every time I go someplace else, I'm like, why are you guys doing it wrong? But at the same time, I love seeing how each temple has its own tradition and how even though it's the same song, everyone's doing it slightly different. And you can just see, oh, this is how this community has interpreted mm-hmm. it. And maybe people from this community came from this part of Japan, or after the diaspora, these communities like came together. Man, we have so many things to talk about.
Well, let me just say that's the beautiful thing about obon as well, because in Japan, in the origination of obon, every village has mm-hmm. their own dance and their yeah. own expression of their area.
Yeah.
And that still is maintained today. So you can go to any area, to any obon, and there will be a dance mm-hmm. that they do
yeah.
that's of their area, whether it's, you know, fishing or whatever it might be about. But it's unique to them. So that's pretty amazing.
We have our own song and dance here in Portland.
Yeah.
We do. And it talks about the mountains, it talks about the bridges and the rivers and stuff like that. So, you know, we've continued that tradition here in the United States.
What's the origination of that song?
The Portland Ondo?
Portland Ondo.
So Portland Ondo is, it was written like 3 years ago by the members of Oregon Buddhist Temple, and that's the temple that hosts the Obon Festival every year here in Portland. And there was sort of like a, hey, Seattle has their own music, and Los Angeles has a ton of music, and you know, I think San Francisco's had music and stuff like that. So there was a, we need a Portland. And so the congregation came together, and there was like, well, it's kind of funny, they all came together in this one meeting. And they said, what do we want to put in the song? And people were like, rivers, mountains, trees, roses. And they just named everything that happens in Portland. And one of the few like professional musicians that goes to OBT, God bless him, shout out to the brother-in-law, Win Kiyama, took all these shouting out of things you want to put in one song and put it into one song. And yeah, I'm going to do a little like a disclaimer here. I do sing the song. So, I mean, I don't make money off of everything. It's just a labor of love that I sing it. But I think it's really funny every time I go to sing the beginning of it, because I'll do it live at Obon, because it just starts with snow-covered mountains, rivers, falls, and trees. And I just hear this list of what everybody in the congregation was just like, well, these are all the things. And it's a really cool song. And it was choreographed by one of your mentors, mm-hmm. Sahomi Tachibana, who
absolutely.
Is like, force in nature here in the Pacific Northwest, in the United States when it comes to
dance. In the United
dance.
States. Actually, in the world,
yeah.
I would say.
Yeah, yeah.
As many students as she has influenced.
Yeah, so yeah. we're so honored that she choreographed the dance, and so mm-hmm. it gets done. But wait, we should probably let people know what's going on here. We're having a Yonsei Sansei conversation. That's what you are tuning into. And Yonsei Sansei are the words for, Yonsei means fourth generation, and Sansei means third generation in Japanese American speak. And so Chisao is of the third generation.
Yep.
And I am of the fourth generation, and we have a lot in common. Unfortunately, we share some of the sad history of the United States that actually probably brought us together in the beginning. When how we first met was a day of remembrance event, right?
At right, the Japanese that you American, organized. that
the
you
Japanese
helped organize.
American Plaza.
Because we were organizing, that was the 75th memorial
oh,
for
yeah.
the issuance of the executive order
That's
9066,
right.
which impacted all of Japanese Americans, yeah. particularly on the West Coast. I did not grow up on the West Coast, but it particularly impacted me as well. But everyone who was organizing for that May, let's see, no, it was in...
We did it in February.
We did, yeah, you did that one, in, you did the vigil in February.
Yeah.
But we were preparing for a huge event at the Expo Center.
Oh, yeah.
In May 6, which was the commemorative date where mm-hmm. Japanese Americans from Portland, Nihonmachi, were taken to the Expo Center, which was the livestock exhibition hall at the time. And so we were all busy preparing for that event.
Yep.
And we looked at each other and said, so are we commemorating the date? And we all said, we don't have it. And then you and your sister and other Yonsei came forward and said, we need to do something.
Mm-hmm.
And so you organized that wonderful event.
Down at the
At the plaza, at the yeah. Japanese American Historical Plaza, also known as the Bill of Rights Plaza.
Yeah, that event, I really appreciate all those sorts of vigils, and, you know, mainly because it's a moment when generations can come together. And that was my goal, at least in organizing that, was bringing Yonsei together. There's lots of Yonsei, in case you're not familiar with the Yonsei history here in Portland. It's that we, you know, the Japanese American community was removed from Portland, and not everybody came back, and that was repeated in all the cities in the West Coast. And so now the kind of younger generation, or that are the young adults right now, are this Yonsei generation. They're very much living in a kind of diaspora where they didn't grow up in a center. And so we have a hard time connecting as a generation and as a cultural community. So my goal was to kind of bring those people together to try to also connect with the Sansei generation. And we still had the Nisei generation, that second generation that went to the concentration camps during World War II. Some of them are still alive today. So the goal of those vigils are to bring everyone together, kind of like Obon.
Yes,
where
exactly.
Everyone like comes together. And so like as a result, ever since that vigil, you and I run into each other at all the Japanese American things. Sometimes we're like organizing.
Well, I went up to you.
Yeah, you did.
I came up to you because I don't think I met you before.
No.
But I was in the beginning stages of organizing a performance. Mm-hmm. And I just had a feeling that you might have that theater experience. I don't know why.
Probably because I came off as very dramatic.
I don't know why, but then afterwards I went up to you and said, excuse me.
Do you do theater?
Do you do theater? And you said...
And I whisked my head to the side and dramatically said, no! Actually, I then said, yeah, is it that obvious? And then from there, yeah, we've done a bunch
you
of
got,
projects.
You, didn't you study theater
I did.
In college?
I did. Well,
yeah.
I studied
in
opera. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I was on stage, and then from there, we've done projects, and we've done stuff for... I've been part of your Hiroshima projects that you've done. So Cheese Out is all sorts of stuff.
Stuff.
Okay, so we're here today to talk about all the Japanese American things, the Nikkei things. That's what the Japanese who don't live in Japan are called Nikkei, the Nikkei community. Talking about emotional legacies. What is that? The multi-generational, intergenerational legacies that we leave behind. And yeah, because Chisa, I got all sorts of questions for you as a sansei. Uh-huh. Okay, so first, you said, I know you grew up in Iowa.
I did.
When did you come to Portland?
The day after I was married, which was a long time ago. Yeah.
But why move from Iowa to Portland?
Well, my husband of the time had grown up in Portland.
Ah.
And so he had really fond memories of his elementary, middle school days in Portland. And then my mother's family is from Hood River. My mother grew up in Oregon. So it was kind of like, well, if we're going to make this thing work, we should just get away and make it work on our own. That was kind of our instinct, you know. And so that's what we did. We didn't know Portland very well at all, other than he had some roots and I had some, you know, family roots in Hood River. So we came, we stayed at a hotel for 3 weeks. And within that time, he found a job and we found an apartment, and that was that.
What was that like for you to return to Oregon, like knowing your family's legacy? Because as so many Japanese American families here in Oregon, that so many people lived in Hood River and they were farming families, and they were quite a community, and then they were all forcefully removed during World War II.
Yeah.
And then your family ended up not returning to Hood River but going to Iowa. So what was that like for you to return? Did it feel like a return for you, I guess?
Not really at first. I think it made it a little bit easier for my mom that I was going to a place that she was kind of familiar with, because I'm an only child.
Ah.
So all of a sudden I'm leaving, and I didn't go to New York, or I didn't go to somewhere where she wasn't familiar with. She knew people here and she had a history here. So I think that maybe helped a little bit. Yeah, and they came to visit quite often.
And did you go back out to like Hood River? When did you finally get
actually
back out there?
No, I didn't start going to Hood River because, you know, growing up, I was totally disconnected from family. So I had no relationship. The only time I went to Hood River was when my grandfather, no, I didn't even go then. I went one time when my grandfather was still alive, and I didn't go when he passed away. I would have been like 8, and that would have been a time where I would have met all my relatives, but my mom didn't take me, and she kind of always regretted that. But I think as I evolved in my questioning about my identity, you know, who am I and where am I from and all of that, I wanted to know more. So that's really when that happened. Yeah.
I was wondering about the Asian American movement and you, because you drop little hints. We're always so busy working. I'll say, so like our relationship is such that we're always working on projects and we end up talking about the history of our people a lot. And every once in a while, Chisao will drop these little stories. And I'm like the other day, oh my goodness, ma'am. We're just like sitting around doing this project thingy. And then she's like, oh, well then, you know, well, this one time at Yuri Kochiyama's apartment in Oakland. And I'm sitting around with all these other Asian like young people. We look at her like, what? You're at Yuri Kochiyama's apartment? What? And then she's like, yeah. And then moves on with the conversation like that's nothing. Like, Chisao, what is because I know Chisao as someone who is very much like this motivation to me to be part of doing the work. Because she just does so much work for the community, and you're very much you've introduced me to other people who do the work and have really taught me so much. But I don't actually know a lot about your own history within like the Asian American movement, except the little hints that you give me, where I'm just like, what? Like, we don't have time to talk about that. Move on. Okay, so now I have you in a room where you can't go.
So I came to Portland. I lived here for a while, almost a year. And then we went back to school and went to Eugene, to the University of Oregon. And it was during that time that the student unions were beginning on the West Coast.
Okay.
So the first one was in Berkeley, and then it kind of moved up. And a lot of the organizing that happened around Asian American identity happened in the student unions. So we formed a student union. And it wasn't just the Asian American student unions. It was also the Black student unions, Native American student unions, Latinx, Latino at that time, student unions. Everybody had a student union. Everybody had a place to go.
Okay.
And I think that we've lost a little bit of that over time. We used to, you know, have our separate kind of things because we were really learning about ourselves. We were reading books together. We were, you know, looking at films, we were having conversations, we were doing potlucks, we were doing fundraisers, we were doing lots and lots of things. And at the time, I also had young children. And so I organized an event called Children's Day. And it was a Saturday that happened in Eugene for about 8 years, every Saturday from 9 to noon. And it was really, I think, through my children that I said, well, what do I need to teach them? What's important about, you know, and if I don't know it, how am I going to teach it? So then there's this convergence of, you know, African-American history and civil rights movement and the Asian American student unions. And in Eugene, there was a class that came out of a like almost a community, I forget what they call it, but it was a community section of the university. And in that class, they decided that they were going to write the bylaws for an organization. They didn't. It wasn't a real organization. They were just imagining what this organization might be, and it was called the Asian American Cultural Center. And they wrote all the bylaws and everything. And then when they were done, the professor and some other students on campus said, "We should do this. We should make this happen." So that's where Children's Day became a part of the Asian American Cultural Center. It brought together Asian Americans throughout the university and the larger city of Eugene, the city of Eugene. And we just did a lot of activities, a lot of fundraisers and educating ourselves and educating the public about what it means to be Asian American. That's when we, you know, read Janice Mirakatani and brought her and Christine Cho, who was a filmmaker in New York, who did work. Her project was called the Mississippi Delta, and she had, you know, now it seems like kind of radical, but people may do this now. But she had a team that went down to make these films about the Chinese sharecroppers in the South, as they related to the African-American sharecroppers and the white sharecroppers. But she had a team for each community. Oh, so wow. When she went to interview, you know, the white sharecroppers, there were white filmmakers and interviewers and so forth for each culture. So it was amazing kind of lesson of how to do that and how to bring community together. The other thing that I learned in that whole experience was we were of all different Asian American backgrounds. And so we were Chinese, Japanese, Korean, Filipino, Vietnamese.
Yeah.
But we were all coming together. So we would share our histories and we would share our literature and everything. And so I just thought that's the way the world was, that it was Asian American, because it was a time coming after the civil rights movement of Black Power and then Yellow Power, and you know, who am I and my identity and my history and what's been labeled as defining us. Instead of that, we are now defining ourselves.
When did you first hear the term Asian American? Is that a phrase you grew up with?
No, that was in college. That was during those days.
What did you think? I mean, like today, where you know, people Asian Pacific Islander, and lots of people don't necessarily like that term Asian. Some people love the term. I have so many opinions about it. I could rant for hours. So I just kind of wonder if, because it was always something that I grew up with. I didn't even think of a time that didn't exist until I got older. So what was that like for you to hear that term Asian American? Was that something exciting
for you? So I feel like it was similar to, like, within the African American community, the terminology was Negro. And then it was Black. Mm-hmm. And at that time, a lot of older African American people were like, don't call me Black, because when they grew up in the South, that was a very negative term, right? And in the Asian American community, it was Oriental.
Yeah.
And so we didn't want to be Oriental. It's like that was a name that someone else gave us.
Yeah.
And we were taking pride and kind of, you know, initiation to claim our own name, no longer Oriental, something that implies a lot of other connotations in history, right? And so Asian American was a breakaway from being Oriental. You'll find, you know, older people still within the Asian American communities still identify themselves as Oriental.
Oh yeah, the Nisei.
Or there's other, you know, Asian groups that will think of themselves as Oriental. But mainly that is a title that was put upon us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was a title that was put upon us. So this Asian American was a title that we claimed. And it gave us more of a global perspective.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, at that time, right? I mean, it was like they always put us all together anyway. They meaning, you know, not Asian Americans, that well, you all look alike. You must all be alike.
Yeah.
We know how different we are.
Yeah.
How varied in our cultures we are as Asian Americans. But as far as someone else looking at us, they would just say, oh, you're all the same.
Yeah. It's amazing. It's amazing to me that people think we're all the same. And like, okay, like for example, like I'm married to a Korean person, and I think of us as extremely culturally different. Like, I do not understand half the things he's doing. I'm like, wait, what is that, right? he's just like, you're so Japanese. But, you know, but when non-Asian people see us, they think that our foods are similar and our languages are similar. All these things are similar. And to me, I might as well be married to someone who grew up on like Saturn. Like we seem so different, you know? And I, the only thing that looks similar to me is that like, yeah, we got the dark hair and stuff like that. Yeah, so it's just amazing to me. But thank you. Thank you, Asian American movement.
Yes.
Thank you so much. Okay, in that movement, we got to talk about the Yuri Kochiyama comment. You're so cool, Chisao. How did you meet her?
Okay, so this is kind of an interesting story.
And by the way, people who don't know who Yuri Kochiyama is, you need to do some Googling. Look up the Google Doodle, because that's what will come up first. Click on it. Learn the knowledge. Okay,
set. Okay. So I was getting ready to go to New York. And during those years of organizing, I was saying we brought Janice Mirkatani and Christine Choi and Nobuko Miyamoto, who at that time was really the voice of Asia America. Mm-hmm. I mean, she had songs that we'd never heard before that we identified. Like, oh, she's singing about us. She's singing for us, right? And so I got to know Nobuko through her work and through our organizing. And so I called Nobuko. I said, Nobuko, I'm getting ready to go to New York. Can you help me out? What do I do? Because she lived in New York for quite some time and even performed on Broadway, right? She was in the original West Side Story.
Oh, yeah.
And Sahomi was there as well. You know, Sahomi was in New York for many, many years
And
worked with So Daiko. And also she did the choreography for Flower Drum Song, you know, one of the famous Broadway performances. And so Nobuko says, well, that's not a question. You go stay with Yuri. I'm like, okay. And so she gave me Yuri's number. And so I call her up and I'm like, hi, you know, and so I stayed with her. And she and her family is quite unique, which I really didn't know at the time. So they're a Japanese American family that lived in Harlem on 125th in Amsterdam in the low-income, high-rise apartments in Harlem. And a very simple means. So when I went to stay with her, you know, took the elevator up, and mainly people of color in those low-income housing units. And it's just a very simple, you know, unit with linoleum floors throughout. And but when I sat in her living room, there was like all these like shelves with Japanese dolls and things, you know, antiques, and and then all these books and posters and awards from like the Betty Shabazz Center, Malcolm X recognizing her. I mean, the Kochiyama family was extremely active in the community of Harlem. Mm-hmm. And I later learned how by staying with her. So that was quite an education for me.
And then that relationship continued?
Mm-hmm. Every time I went to New York, I stayed with Yuri.
Wow. What advice that she ever gave you has stuck with you?
It actually wasn't what she said so much as what she did.
Ooh,
and what I observed. Okay. So Yuri is there such a word as extreme activist? But she was really a conduit.
Yeah.
And she was the glue, she was the hub in the wheel.
Yeah.
And the spokes were many, many organizations and individuals that were active at the time. Not only in New York, but throughout the East Coast and even in other parts of the world. And so what Yuri would do is people would call her and she's like, well, we've got to organize about that. And she'd get all the right people and she'd bring them together and they'd all go meet up in her living room and they'd have a meeting, and that was what catalyzed their organizing, right? The planning and everything happened in her apartment in Harlem. And she had, I was helping her with a mailing, and she pulled out her notebooks, and her notebooks were all different colors, and there was maybe six or seven, I don't know. And then within each notebook, she had color-coded names. And so when she did a mailing, she'd pull out this notebook or that notebook, and then she'd go, oh, this only goes to the people written in red. Oh, this one only goes to the people in this color. Yeah. Because if we mix these people up, they won't get any work done, and they'll be talking and arguing the whole meeting long. So these are the people that need to be at this meeting. And so she'd make the flyer, she'd mail the flyer out, she'd organize the group, she'd call everybody up, she'd find out what needed to be done. You know, so she was definitely an inspirational person and a conduit that made things happen. And
she's like the definition of an organizer. Like, she knows how to be most effective.
Totally.
Well, it's nice to hear that the history of organ is still the same.
Yeah.
Now you have to really pick and choose who's going to be most effective in a room together.
Right. And what you're trying to accomplish.
Yeah.
And if you don't have much time, like if there's, you know, a court case coming up or something that is imperative that it be organized now, mm-hmm. you want to be the most efficient that you can be. And there were multiple groups going on. This is not just one group, mm-hmm. multiple groups. So the way that Yuri is known is when Malcolm X was murdered at the Avalon Ballroom in Harlem, it was Yuri that was there holding him.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of an iconic photo.
Yeah.
Yeah. So she knows, you know, she raised 6 children in Harlem, and so she was an integral part of that community.
That's an amazing
years.
Woman.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so much of just the work, and then just, I don't know, an inspiration for so many generations after, because she was active. I mean, in her activism, you know, all the way into her 90s.
Right, yeah.
And making trouble. I'll say that, making all the good kind of trouble.
So one of the things I remember that she did say is she was walking me to the subway to show me, you know, how to go. And I was like, I don't remember what I was saying, but I was just so amazed in observing her. And she said, you know, I'm just really fortunate because I make Bill's lunch every day and he can walk to work, and I don't, you know, I can get on the train wherever I need to go, and the money that we save by him not working far away, you know, save by making him lunch, we can put into flyers. And I don't know why, but when I left that first time, I'm like, what on earth can I, you know, because Japanese are really big on omiyage, on gifts.
Oh, yeah.
What on earth can I get them?
Yeah.
So I was walking in Soho. I was on my way back that way, and I passed a post office. I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm just going to get a roll of stamps. And so that night, the next morning, I was leaving, right? I gave him a card, and I gave him... And they both, like, stopped in their tracks. Bill actually cried.
Really?
And he said, this is the nicest, most thoughtful gift we've ever received. And I'm like, it seemed like such a small thing to me.
Yeah.
Right, but that's the sacrifices on that level that they were doing to make things happen. You know, who was going to print the flyer? Who was going to mail the flyer? I mean, this was before internet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this was before email. When you came into Yuri's world, she'd like, hi, how are you doing? Tell me what you do. And, you know, give me your... She would make a file folder on you. And she had a room of file folders. Like, there were so many file folders, you could barely open the door.
Oh my gosh.
It was like out of file cabinets and into boxes, and it was all alphabetized, but she had a folder on you.
Wow. That's someone who wants to get stuff done.
Yeah.
Appreciate that.
Yeah.
So much. Well, if you're just tuning in, you're tuned into KBOO Community Radio, and I am talking with Chisel Hata, teacher, dancer, actor, artist, writer, activist, all, just getting the work done in life.
Mom,
yeah, mentor, mom to many on many, many, many levels. She talked a little bit earlier about Nobuko Miyamoto, and Nobuko Miyamoto is really well known for her album Grain of Sand from her band Yellow Pearl. Grain of Sand being the first known Asian American album that came out. It was released in 1972, and we have We Are the Children from that album.
We are the children of the migrant worker. We are the offspring of the concentration camp. Sons and daughters of the railroad builder who leave their stamp on America. We are the children of the Chinese waiter, born and raised in the laundry room. We are the offspring of the Japanese gardener who leave their stamp on America. Sing a song for ourselves. What have we got to lose? Sing a song for ourselves. We got the right to choose. We got the right to choose. We got the right to choose. Foster children of the Pepsi generation. Cowboys and Indians ride. Red man ride.
That was We Are the Children from Yellow Pearl's 1972 groundbreaking album, Grain of Sand,
which is shortly
I don't think so. I don't know, is your microphone? Yeah, I think there's your microphone.
Okay. Which is shortly or in a short amount of time going to be part of the Smithsonian Institute.
Yeah.
Nobuko is working really hard these days to really get her work recorded and archived.
When that album came out in 1972, how did you find out about it? Did you know Nobuko at the time?
I didn't know her at the time. I just think it was, you know, everybody was communicating, and not by email because we didn't have email, but by books and by letters and, you know. But she had a play, which was the first Asian American play, musical, called Chop Suey. And it was about a family in Chinatown. And so we had brought her play to Eugene and then later on to Portland. So we knew about her. And we had this kind of informal way that we heard about artists who were doing work in Seattle and then, you know, all the way down to Los Angeles, San Francisco. So it became this kind of I-5 corridor, which people, you know, went up and down on. Frank Chin, La Sininada, released the Big IE, which at that time was a seminal work for Asian American and Asian American movement. And prior to that, Frank Chin had been a founding director of the Asian American Theater Workshop. And so there was a, you know, real communication that was happening. And then Frank and had come up to Portland, actually came to Seattle. So the very first Day of Remembrance was organized in Seattle for Puyallup, which was the assembly center where Seattle people went. And the Day of Remembrance at that time was an idea. And the idea was, we need to educate people. So many people don't know about these camps, about these concentration camps. We need to let people know. And so they were planning caravans to go from one camp to another camp, pilgrimages. And then one of the actions was deciding that in each city where the people were taken from, that we would try to organize these events. So after Puyallup, the people that organized that event, which was Frank Abe, who is the conscience in the Constitution. Mm-hmm. He made a film and does lectures and wrote a book. He and his wife at the time were organizers of that first one, Frank Chin. So they all came to Portland, and they helped us organize our first Day of Remembrance.
Mm-hmm. Something we still do to this day.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. This ever important event. Can we talk a little about that, about emotional legacies and like why we continue to do that, or the importance of I guess, you know, when you were saying that, the Day of Remembrance and we got to tell people, I wonder if that has changed. So, because when I organized my Day of Remembrance vigil thing that we were talking about at the top of the show, my motivation was to recognize the Japanese American community, because that is an ever increasing, I don't know if you want to call it a problem. Yeah, I think it's a problem of as the generations go along, now we're in fourth generation, fifth generation is now around two, that the history is being forgotten by our own community because, I mean, in a very purposeful way that the government wanted us to not pass on that information. You know, our grandparents didn't talk about it. I know very, very little about my family in camps, and I'm only now finding out that what I do know is a lot compared to a lot of other Japanese Americans, which I find really sad because I know so, so little. And so part of wanting to put on these vigils and even have these discussions for me is about how do I just let other people within my own community not forget what happened. But when you guys were organizing there and you're first setting up Day of Remembrance, was it to educate other people, or was it to educate yourself?
It was mainly to have our community talk and remember and be okay about talking about the experience.
Was that a difficult thing to do?
It was extremely difficult because people, you know, many Issei were still alive. This was before redress, which passed in 88, and the hearing was in 80, so this was way before, like 79. And so it was, I think it was twofold. It was one main priority is to get the community, because we'd been dispossessed of land. Mm-hmm. We'd been, you know, dispersed from our communities. We'd been, you know, separated from families. We've been denied our language. I mean, there is so many things that fed into that part of our emotional legacy. So whether
emotional trauma.
Yeah, emotional trauma, that yeah. traumatic part of our legacy, right? Yeah. That when we started talking about it and when we started organizing and all that kind of happened, to me it's a blur because it just seemed like it all happened at the same time. But it was about healing, recognizing, and speaking out loud our truth was really what it was about.
Such a radical action.
I mean, there were 2,000 people at the first Day of Remembrance.
Wow.
At the Expo Center, which was the actual location of the Portland yeah. Assembly Center, which formerly was the Portland Exhibition Livestock Hall. And, you know, the mayor spoke, 442nd was representative, many people were there in the community, and the Issei cooked food for 2,000 people.
Wow.
We had obento for everyone. We had the first art exhibit. So we called people to bring art that had been made during camp to exhibit in the hall. It was a huge, huge event, and I think it was a reckoning, you know, of
yeah.
that time period of people like coming forward and saying it's okay to recognize that this happened.
Wow.
In the space, in the actual space.
That is like heartbreaking to hear about. I mean, I can't even imagine like the Issei, the first generation that came over. So like that was my great grandparents and my family. I can't even imagine them going to a Day of Remembrance thing or even acknowledging that that was something negative that happened to them during World War II, because they were very much part of that. The convo that we always talk about, how that Issei, the Nisei, the generations that went would often just say, oh, everything's fine. Oh, it was fine. We were just patriotic. And they would always put forward this message that everything was fine. But then you come to hear, as more of the stories come out, just of how much pain and suffering, you know, came out, and that all that dialogue that they gave to us later of everything was fine, you know, was very much trying to save themselves. It was about survival and also trying to, I think, protect us from their traumatic legacy.
Right, yeah.
You know, and mm-hmm. I feel like when you're younger, maybe you feel like you're protected from it, but as you're older, you have all these questions, and it just, wow. It's just like,
so in my growing up, you know, there may be 10 to 15 Japanese-American families that settled in Des Moines, Iowa. Most of the people that were in Roar or Jerome, Arkansas, either moved to Denver or Chicago. Mm-hmm. So that's why you get a lot of Japanese American communities.
Yeah. Pretty big out there.
East of the Rockies.
Yeah.
But they never talked about it. So my mom and dad only spoke Japanese in my house when other people came over. And they were gathered around that round table that's now in my tiny room, speaking Japanese. But they were talking about camp. And they were talking so that none of the children
could understand
what was going on. So, yeah.
Oh, that's so...
So we didn't even get it was fine, it was good. Yeah. We didn't even know.
You don't even know.
So it wasn't until I was in maybe fifth or sixth grade, well, I had experienced some racist comments growing up as I was little,
yeah.
But I didn't really understand what it was about. I just was, you know, feeling the feeling. And I went to a Bluebird or a Campfire Girl camp. That's in the Midwest, right?
Yeah.
And we were all gathered in the mess hall for lunch or something. And the leaders asked us, well, how many of your mothers, you know, were in camp? And I had heard the word camp spoken in my house. So I just figured, oh, yeah, my mom was in camp. So I raised my hand, you know, really high and proud. And when I went home, I told my mom, you know, well, they asked us this question. And I told them that you were in camp. Was it like the camp I went to? Is it Campfire Girl Camp? That's when she first said, well, no, it wasn't like that at all. And my mom came to talk about it more and more as time went on, but she also witnessed my kind of evolution in questioning my own identity as the years went on. And there was a period of time where I was kind of angry that I didn't know, and certainly angry that I didn't know Japanese.
Oh, yeah.
I felt like I was denied a part of my culture because I didn't have the language. So, you know, I didn't speak to my parents for about a year. This was when I was in college and, you know, really learning about history of Japan. And
yeah. I feel like that's something that's really common within our community from that third and fourth generation, is the I don't speak Japanese, but you knew members of your family who spoke Japanese, and why wouldn't they teach you? I remember, like, because I'm kind of different from a lot of Japanese Americans that I meet, in that I have one parent that is a sansei like you, and then my dad is from Japan. And so it was always like, oh, goodness, why am I not being taught the language of my dad, right? Because that was literally his language. And it was just so painful to watch, like, my grandparents speak Japanese to my dad and my mom even understanding a bit. And so seeing all these people who had this capability to give me my culture, but then constantly being like, oh, you don't need to know Japanese, and it being part of a protective thing, them trying to make me super American. And yeah, we've talked about this before. Mm-hmm. We've had a trauma circle before for Japanese Americans where people share just like what that is, and, you know, just talking about how painful it is to have your language stripped from you. There's one time on KBO I heard something that I thought was really powerful. Somebody said, there is no culture without language, and there is no language without culture. And I remember just hearing that, and it just hit me so hard. It was just such an eloquent way to put what all that pain is.
So I've had to reframe all of that.
Oh, yeah.
In my defining my identity.
Yeah. How's that? What is that for you? How have you changed that over the years?
Well, I have come to accept and understand. Well, not always understand. a part of my emotional legacy, which is ancestral. And knowing the language connects you to that, you know, more directly. But just because you don't have the language doesn't mean you don't have that connection. So in my mind, I was like, I don't have the language, I don't have the connection. And then it was when I came to Portland, I started studying Japanese dance. And I started going to Obon. And, you know, I almost had this feeling like I grew up in Iowa, I don't know what it means to be Japanese. And now there's all these Japanese people, and I've never been around this many Japanese American people. And so I had to go like, wait a minute, just stop, you know, because you're just as Japanese as anybody else. I mean, when I look at, you know, where my mom came from, where my dad came from, whether or not I knew the language was really not as significant as me accepting that I was just as Japanese American as anyone else, right?
That's so, that's such a difficult thing. Okay, so you've been doing work. We have like just 10 more minutes, and so I want to talk about the work that you are doing right now, that you've been really addressing this topic of emotional legacies, and you've been doing talks, and just the work that I've seen you do in the last few years has so much to do with people looking at their identities and talking about that, and what does it mean to transform what acceptance of self is, and almost like radical acceptance of self, because things like this are so hard.
Yeah.
People think we look in the mirror and we go, oh, yeah, I'm Japanese. Okay, sure. Yeah, I accept that. And like, that's not an easy thing. That's
right.
Something that took me decades to figure out.
You know, we've talked about the trauma of camp and the children of the camps, which we are the legacy. We're the ancestors of the children of camps. And it took me a while to really get to that point of, even though I didn't have that experience, even though, you know, I didn't live in the camp, that's part of my parents' experience, my community's experience, and so therefore, I know it. Yeah. It's genetic. It's almost genetic. Just like when I started studying Japanese dance, which is Nihon Buyo, which is classical Japanese dance, while I was a trained dancer at that point going into Buyo and an older student, which is highly unusual because you usually start when you're really young, I knew the moves, and it freaked me out. I knew the moves that were next before the teacher showed me. And I thought, oh, this is so weird. You know, and then I'm like, wait a minute, that's really kind of cool. I knew exactly what was going to happen. You know, before it happened. So it's that kind of trusting that ancestral knowing, that genetic cellular, you know, information is there to access, not that it's covered up, you know. And for the for when we were organizing with the redress for redress and reparations, we always talked about that experience, and the analogy was as a rape victim. So, you know, the fact that our parents and our grandparents didn't talk about it, when you relate it to or parallel that to someone who has been, a woman who's been raped, they don't run around talking about it. It the first thing that happens is really, what did I do?
Yeah.
I must have done something. You know, it's a kind of a human reaction. And as far as the emotional legacies, I feel like everyone has them. And so the clearer we are about what ours are, you know, it's not just about trauma, it's also what we eat and how we think and how we react and
how we pass on joy.
Yeah, how we pass on joy and what gifts we might get, you know. I mean, so it's knowing almost intuitively, trusting that intuitive knowing that we are not trained in our society to know, feel, accept. It's almost the opposite. So I think that that's what we need to go to.
Like the Gosei generation, the fifth generation, is they're getting quite old. I like think of them all as like babies, but they're all like in high school and stuff now. Right. You know, they're the latest generation. What hopes do you have for them. They're one generation even farther. They're the generation that didn't get to meet survivors of camp, most of them. What do you hope that they continue forward with their emotional legacy, or how they address that?
Well, a lot of the Gosei are mixed, you know, interracial, biracial. And so they have different ways of seeing the world because of that, in a way that I wouldn't know or understand completely. But what I'm trying to do is preserve the history and the legacy that we have experienced and that our generations before us have experienced, so that history is accessible and not discoverable. You know, I mean, it's discoverable by them when they first find out, but it should be accessible.
Yeah.
You know, not like I have to hunt it down or I have to, because the people that would tell you directly are no longer here.
Yeah.
It doesn't make the history or the experience any less valid. It makes it even more valid because it's part of, which is, you know, an American legacy. It's all of our story. It's not just my story. Just because I'm Japanese American, I have that lens.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're Caucasian or whatever ethnicity you are, we have that ability in America to translate into other people's emotional legacies.
Do you have hope for the Yonsei generation, the fourth generation, the ones who are raising the fifth generation right now? Do we give you hope or do we make you panic?
Actually, I think maybe this was Gosei. She's in high school, right? That would be Gosei.
Mm-hmm.
So I was in the Oregon Nikkei Legacy Center yesterday, and a high school teacher who is Japanese American but not from here brought some students in, and she wanted to know more. And she's like, I'm so interested. I just really need to know. You know, I'm so glad that you're doing these, you know, circles and healing moments together. And I want to talk about it. And just because she wants to know gives me hope.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm hopeful.
I'm hopeful.
I'm hopeful. I will say, like a couple years ago, I was really discouraged because, you know, that's how the work goes, right? You go through ebb and flow. You're like, yeah, then, oh, I should quit this and just bury myself in a hole. Where I got really frustrated about, like, how does the younger generation come together and actually feel connected? And then lo and behold, the younger Yonsei, the ones who know how to use the internets 1,000 times better than me, have been making these amazing communities over the last year and are having those discussions where they're saying, how do we connect? Oh, let's create Facebook groups. Let's do this. And it's kind of sad that it's only taken up until 2019 just for them to do that. But it's amazing to see them wanting to have the conversations because, you know, I'm almost 40 and I see, oh, wow, you have to pass that. Like, you can't wait till the end of your life to try to pass. I hope you become an old person, but start passing it now. And
right,
I see,
right.
Oh, so it's so important for me to talk to people in high school now and set up that next.
And grade school.
Yeah, and grade from the time they're really little. I got a nephew who we try to teach him the radical language. Oh, it's 8:57, which means we got to get going.
Got to go. Thank you so much, Jenny Yokoyama.
You are doing a million things. If people want to learn more about what you're doing, how can they find out about you?
Chisaohata.com. is my website.
Look at that. Chisaohata. Mm-hmm. She's doing all the work. Thank you, Chisao, for coming in and just for being awesome.
Thank you.
Okay, stay tuned. We are having more Asian Pacific American Heritage Month programming today all the way till 4:00. Coming up next is my interview with Apano because Apano, before we go to promos, let's just pre-applaud Apano because they are doing the work for the APA community here in Oregon. Stay tuned.
All right. Thank you so much. I got it.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Dessert Evening with Rumi on Saturday, May 4th from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. at Tabor Space in Portland. Dessert Evening with Rumi will be an evening of sharing Rumi poetry and stories, live Turkish music, sacred dance of whirling dervishes, and desserts donated by Portland individuals and businesses. Again, that's Dessert Evening with Rumi on Saturday, May 4th from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. at Tabor Space, 5441 Southeast Belmont Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Wild and Scenic Film Festival on Saturday, May 4th from 6 to 9 p.m. at Clark College in Vancouver, Washington. The Wild and Scenic Film Festival will be screening a collection of 9 of the best short films from the 2019 festival. Before the screening, there will be a reception with beverages and light food and a raffle to support the Cascade Forest Conservancy. Again, that's the Wild and Scenic Film Festival on Saturday, May 4th from 6 to 9 p.m. at Clark College, 1933 Fort Vancouver Way in Vancouver. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.